Oh my, Sam found us Paul Robeson singing Joe Hill. I take a moment. We better say something about Joe Hill. He had the greatest line, don't mourn for me, boys, organize. And you probably know, Phil, that he was with the Wobblies, Joe Hill.
Right.
And he's obviously, you can't hide from these kind of ideas. He's a saint in labor history, a real person. He was, the Rebel Girl, his song, was about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who came to visit him. He wrote a song about her. And when he was knew he was going to be executed in Utah, he said, I would like to be cremated, and I want my ashes put in envelopes and sent all over the world where we have organizers, people working to organize workers. So he said, but with one qualification, I don't want any of my ashes in Utah. I don't want to be found dead in Utah.
Well, boy, that's a sentiment that is understandable.
I say, Joe, I really do appreciate Joe Hill, but I have some relatives buried in Utah. Nice people. One of them in the town where Butch Cassidy's from. Butch Cassidy was an English-born Mormon, and he's in a small town in Utah. That's where he was from. We don't know where he went, do we? I mean, I don't think they ever found the remains of Butch Cassidy.
I don't.
Him and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah, I couldn't put
you
my
never saw
on it.
Paul Newman? And
no, I saw
what
it.
What is this?
Of course I saw Paul Newman.
What was the name of the movie? Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid?
Yeah.
And
we even have a film festival called Sundance, which is to, you know.
That's where they got the, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, which honors it.
That was Robert Redford.
Right.
Who's cursed by being handsome. He's so good looking that it gets in the way of being a wonderful actor. All long way of still going back to the issue of how grateful we are we were able to talk about this convention.
Phil, I want to comment on something that Tony said that was, I was disappointed to hear it, which is that nobody at this convention is talking about the issue of raiding. And the culture of raiding other unions is a very lamentable, it's now a permanent feature of the Canadian labor movement. And it started with Unifor when they were the CAW. It's been a real disaster for the labor movement. It diverts all kinds of energy and resources of the labor movement when people have to organize their own members in defense of their union rather than going out and organizing unorganized workers. And that's Unifor's signature contribution. You know,
everybody should bring a bit of humility to the subject.
Yeah.
Steelworkers, assisted by the CIA and others, raided mine mill smelter workers.
Yes, they did.
And the Canadian Seamen's Union, of which, by the way, Hank Snow was once a member. I mean, how many people know that?
Well, you know it, but now your
Canadian
listeners know it.
Right. It was a very proud organization, and it was violent. You know the name Hal Banks.
Hal Banks was the mafioso that the CIA and the Canadian government agreed could come to Canada, and bust.
Yeah, an American came in and with blackjack tactics.
Yeah,
brass knuckles. I knew a guy who had been in the Canadian Seamen's Union who was mentioned in a good poem, let's not oversell. Humility is not a bad idea. Milton Acorn wrote a poem about traveling on the 401 with Joe Hensby, who I knew. Of course, I knew both of them, but Hensby had been in the Seamen's Union. And he was obsessive talking about how bitter that experience was. And he told me, I mean, colorful things. You think about Joe Hill, you know, you have to have esprit de corps, we call it in the Marines, but it's also applied throughout culture. People have to have incentive, have to have pride, and really knowing they're doing the right thing and willing to do it and to go the, not just concerned about the first and most immediate things, but the bigger, as they say it in the movie, the big picture, you know, the fate of all workers, not just, you know, your local of this particular place. But to give an idea of what the Seamen's Union was like, he said when a new guy would come aboard ship, he was given Jack London's The Iron Heel to read. He said, welcome to the crew. Here's Jack London's The Iron Heel. Whoa, you want to, by the way, that's a sobering book. I had a night shift once at a chemical fertilizer plant where I would read between, what, 11 and 8 in the morning, something like that.
That's all right. A lot of us have worked on night
that,
shift.
We you know did you, that. Night
you,
shift.
You know what you do on night shift. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, yeah. You got to stay awake, right?
Basically, they want to, you know, keep the thing percolating and not have it burned down. So I did my part. But Jack London's The Iron Heel is a rough book written by a blue-collar man who became a great author. But he was the real deal. Jack London had calluses. He wrote about a people who worked. He had them. Yeah. It was crazy. I'm not going to say that Jack wasn't insane. I think Jack London was quite mad. But judged by his fellow Americans at the time, I'd say he's about 50-50. Most of them were crazier than he was. We'll come to that again sometime. Phil, you and I need to talk about the an important subject, and I want to refer people to an author, John Pilger, an Australian writer, not because I have him in front of me, or but because he's has been, over the years, one of the best writers and most courageous. And he is his concern is propaganda, and he's talking about the Ukraine matter, which is coming back to bite us about once a week. Somebody stumbles over reality. And so
I think that pace is picking up now. It's about three
times. The pace is picking up.
Three times a week now.
Yeah. Yeah, we've just been through the turbine. Now we're in what?
Well, amnesty.
Amnesty got hit today. What do you know about it?
Well, what I know is that Amnesty, which has often aligns themselves with...
Often,
usually, always.
Shall we say nine tens
aligns themselves with the needs and interests of the U.S. Empire
and U.K.
and the U.K.
The
especially
Five Eyes, right? And the White Anglo-Saxon alliance.
Interestingly, they pointed out. They said, you know, of course, we're saying all these horrible things about the Russians, and we'll continue saying them. We got to point out that Ukraine is violating many of the laws of war and is actually putting civilians in harm's way as a military tactic, and that's a war crime. And boy, oh boy, it says, you can't call me a war criminal. Oh, the hurt feelings coming from the Ukrainian government and the organizations here that love Ukraine.
Now, by the way, who did you read so far on this? Because, go ahead.
Well, I see, the thing is this, when you're reading things on Twitter and Facebook, you don't remember whose article it is.
Ah.
But
you're trying to save your Facebook.
But one of the things is that Zelensky was saying, you know he uses over the top rhetoric all the time. These are the greatest war criminals in history. What they've done to us is beyond belief. And then he says, you can't criticize us for anything.
No.
Yeah.
But that was agreed.
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you, today's the New York Times ties itself in a knot trying to talk about this. Yeah. Here's anybody who's studied military history or experienced military and all that, the fact is that the military lies, and they have to. If they're engaged with each other, I mean, they're trying to win a particular strategic tactical encounter, they can't tell you what they're going to do. I mean, it's like the Kansas City Chiefs come to the line of scrimmage. The quarterback doesn't say, by the way, I'm going to pretend to hand the ball to this guy. Then I'm going to throw a 40-yard pass to that guy. If you did that, you would lose. So They say they pretend they're doing this, and meanwhile they're doing that. And so you've entered a zone of untruth, because that is not their job to share with you what they're doing. On either side, it's a given that they're going to be concerned about flow of information. And to the extent that they can control it, they will do it. This is because that's part of their job. The Pentagon says, and their best, this is not a secret, they have a term called full spectrum dominance. I recall I was on a flight coming back from Africa, and I had a really great paper, the International Herald Tribune. That was I'd love to be on flying, who were they, Dutch airline anyway. And that was their favorite paper, and I couldn't wait to read it. And it was an interview with a Pentagon big shot, retired, and he said, you don't start any engagement without full spectrum dominance. You don't want any, you don't want what they, in political circles, they call leaks. No leaking. It's got to, you have to have everything under control. Okay, and I would say fair is fair. I understand that. But then you move over into what is called journalism, and that's where John Pilger's name come up. And I recommend just Googling. You'll find it quicker than I could find it if I talked about it. John Pilger. Any rate, so why, if you're called journalist, why are you playing along? Isn't your job to say, well, so-and-so says, and the other guy says, but our reporter tells us that this is what he has seen with his own eyes, and he's reporting that to you. That doesn't happen anymore. And Phil, you might remember, anybody knows about the Vietnam experience? The military decided that the reason they lost was media. They could not control what they were doing. A guy from Toronto, what was his name? Mordecai something. He ended up at 60 Minutes. At any rate, he took the CBS footage of the Marines using cigarette lighters to set fire to people's homes, if you remember. And, you know, that he was doing what you're supposed to do. Let the people see what, after all, it's their army, and let them see what's going on that they're paying for, and in which their children, by the way, may be going to kill and or be killed. So that reporting was essential for the American people. But the military decided we will never let that happen again. And for example, when was the last time you saw an American soldier photograph of his corpse? Well, you didn't. That is not to be shown. You got close under Bill Clinton. We ran a little exercise in Morley Safer from Harper Collegiate, a brilliant, wonderful writer. I would call him, he earned this, a deeply cynical man, having rubbed elbows with the really wonderful people, he became less and less happy with the world. But again, back to the point, they said, no more of this. From now on, we will control the story. Why are the media playing along? And but that may be ending. We'll see. I mean, Phil, you mentioned Amnesty International. They haven't actually withdrawn what they said.
No, that's right.
They apologized. They said if they hurt in someone's feelings.
Well, which is bizarre. I mean, like, if you're presenting what
you
say.
You
let
the chips fall.
Right. You have a report. And say, we have a report. This is what we have to say.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you never say, well, by the way, we already checked to see if anybody's feelings would be hurt by publishing this report. Then you never say that.
Yeah. No, it's... we have to. That's where we should be very demanding of. And of course, I mentioned media, the other area where we're supposed to be protected by alert people is in our parliamentarians, whose job it is to, in representing us, to ascertain what is going on and to best inform us as to whether or not we should be doing what we're doing or should we change what we're doing. But we're in lockstep. NATO is like watching a company march down a parade ground. Everybody in step, step, step. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. And you say, is nobody going to say, hey, I don't have to march. I'm not in this army. But they're in. And it is where we need to do our work. And frankly, of course, Phil, you and I have already talked about a story. There's a journal called Passages, and they have an item today criticizing the Weekend Globe for a profile of a young woman whose husband is a POW in Russia. He was captured at the Azovstal. He is described as, I think, is he a lieutenant general?
Yeah, lieutenant colonel, I think.
Very odd. I cannot believe he has that rank. There's nothing to indicate he has the military wherewithal to. But there were so many problems with that. And it points up where Canadians need to come in. Canada has failed. I want to join the chorus that says, we're failing Ukraine. Yes, yes. Canada has failed Ukraine. It failed starting in 2014 when there was an American-backed coup. The elected leader of the country was removed, or he agreed to step down in order that there be a new election. That didn't happen. Those who did that, who made that coup, made new rules. And among the new rules they made, and this is where Canada's betrayal of Ukraine begins, 2014, they didn't complain. Then the second aspect of that was, and you'll find it in the Globe and Mail today and yesterday and actually in the Amnesty report, and the New York Times reporting on it, they acknowledge that in the eastern part of the country, we all know there's a river, and on the east of that river is people who historically have been friendly to or identified as Russian. So that's the nub of the problem. And those who made a coup in 2014 said, oh, now we are the government, and we can enforce our rule on those people in the east who said, hey, the guy we voted for, you just removed, and he stepped down because you agreed to have an election. Now you didn't have an election. Well, that's where cooperation in society breaks. And there a formula was offered called the Minsk Accord, the Minsk Agreements, to resolve it. That was, again, 2014. But they did not resolve it. And no president, no leader, certainly not Mr. Zelensky, by the way, he promised the most. He's the one who promised the most in terms of he's going to deal with the Minsk matter. He's going to reassure Ukrainians who live in what is called the Donbass are comfortable being Ukrainians. He said that when he ran. And remember, please, everybody, he was overwhelmingly elected as the peace candidate. Okay. There's a people called the Azov Brigade. The Azov Brigade, they were not in Mr. Zelensky's camp. They were anxious to enforce the new authority that took power in 2014. And in 2014, they began armed conflict in Donbass, fighting those people. They tried to take it. They did, by the way, take the place called Mariupol. Mariupol, politically, in terms of its votes and all, had been with the Donbass in terms of their political orientation, protection of Russian language, et cetera. So by force, that brigade took over in Mariupol. And so, we should know that the United States Congress in 2014, 2015 identified them as extremists and even terrorists. They used the word. And neo-fascists, etc. That wasn't doubted. But once we reached the crisis we're in, starting in February, with the so-called special military operation of Russia, which is, of course, a result of a great power conflict of whether or not NATO should be bordering Russia, and Russia said no. And they offered solutions, but nobody on the other side was interested. Therefore, we get what we got. Now, for the people of Donbass, you cannot debate it. It's not. They have been fighting since 2014. So when people say, "Well, houses have been burned, schools have been blown up, people died," 13,000 people, it seems to be the common number, died between 2014 and 2022. So, where was Canada? Well, Canada was supplying weapons throughout that time, and also providing training for these people. So Globe does this story, and they say, well, you know, that the Azov big people have been called right-wing extremists. But they say, but it's not that, but they use the word, they brought in the word but. They are now part of the Ukrainian army, as though that somehow cleanses them. Actually, for anybody who cares about fascists, I still care. I've called me nostalgic. I thought World War II was a good idea. I think defeating Hitler, actually, I thought that was a pretty good idea. So when I hear about fascists, I tend to say, well, do something. So anyway, this idea that they're now with the army, that actually enlarges the problem, and it does. It doesn't do away with it. It actually makes it actually more problematic. And this is where again the media have let us down, because they have been told. We now were told that they were the heroes of Azovstal for a period of time. Well, they surrendered. I remember when we were told they were militarily wonderful and they had all kinds of things they were going to do, and they didn't do it. And they surrendered, which I don't blame them. I think that was a good idea, too. When they surrendered, you can watch it. Go on YouTube. They were asked to take their shirts off, the men. Well, I guess the women were, too, under different circumstances. But I saw a lot of people with swastikas. With one gentleman had a Hitler, really nice, professional job of Hitler on his shoulder. So, you know, why didn't they share that with us? I mean, Morley Safer showed us the guy with the cigarette lighter burning a hut. Why can't we see the pictures? Let me make up my own mind. I mean, the Globe might be right. Maybe the Star is right. Maybe they're all absolutely right. But don't tell me that you don't have those pictures. Because we're discussing whether or not they're extremists. I would call a guy with a Hitler portrait on his shoulder an extremist. I'm going to just say right off the bat. I don't know his mom and dad, but I kind of go with the line that he's pretty extreme. And that, by the way, once we face that, you can say the guy next to him is not a bad fellow. I don't mind. It doesn't mean that I don't believe in guilt by association. I just want to know, why were they there? And why aren't they mentioned? And the answer is because we have full spectrum dominance, and media have bought into and are doing their job of blocking. They're blocking information. But Phil, as you pointed out a while ago, you know, some of the times when they get into doing it, they can actually trip over themselves. You know, there's a story now about they said the Russians have shelled a nuclear facility. Is that what it is? What do you call it?
A reactor.
Or something like it. Anyhow, so they said, oh, they did that. And the Russians said, we did not do that. That was done by Ukrainians. And the Ukrainians said, no, we didn't do that. But the British intelligence in the British newspaper, I read it. They said, well, the Russians are getting, they're putting their personnel right next to that facility. Therefore, they get shot at, and therefore you have damage. And you say, I thought you were denying that. You know, like, you guys get your story straight. You know, that's why I asked you a while ago about sources, because we're living in a world now where you don't need one witness. You need three or four witnesses. And to see how they make the story work out, there was this attack on a POW camp. The Russians have a POW camp where they put the Azovstal people and others, and it got hit. And the Globe did an interview with a relative of one of the POWs, and she said, oh, well, the Russians did that because they want them dead. And you say, well, why did, if they wanted them dead, why did they take them prisoner? Huh? I'm just, if you would help me with that. That's where people, please, I would just urge you over and over, use your critical faculty. It won't hurt. It's not permanent. Just for the time being, you can go back to being gullible in the future. But right now, you do have critical faculty, and look at all reports, and I'm telling you from the beginning, no general is going to tell you the truth, because that's not his job. His job is to win the battle, and whatever he tells you is to help him win it. He's not there to say, man, did we get beaten? Woo. And oh, Hank Snow, are we near the end? Hank Snow, former member of the Canadian Seamen's Union. I've got to thank Sam for this. This is Taylor Report. See you next week.